From the Gettysburgian and 91.1 WZBT Gettysburg, I'm Jamie Welch, and this is On Target.
I'm Ben Ponce. Today on Target, we'll give an update on the college's emergency response procedures and provide an update on the latest happenings in Student Senate.
Then, we'll talk to Janelle Wurzberger and Chris Barnes about Open Access Week at Musselman Library. Stay with us.
All right. We're ready for another exciting edition of On Target. Let's get right into it. Last week, we mentioned that we would be looking into the college's response to two recent emergency incidents on campus. First, a power outage that occurred a week ago last Wednesday on October the 11th. And then the week before, there was an incident where DPS dispatchers advised students to shelter in place after a report came into DPS that there was a suspect being pursued by police who was believed to be armed. So on Monday, I sat down with Bill Lafferty, the director of the Department of Public Safety, as well as Jamie Yates, the college's director of communications and media relations, and David Taylor, the associate director of DPS, who frequently is on duty to distribute these emergency alerts. Some takeaways from that conversation. Bill Lafferty told me that, first of all, not every power outage is deemed an emergency. They believed that this power outage was going to last 3 to 4 hours. It ended up lasting a little bit more than an hour and a half. So while the campus emergency response team was activated, it was not a bona fide emergency, which may have affected how the college responded. I also want to note that the library, which closed along with the Jaeger Center, Bill Lafferty seemed a little bit unsure why that happened. I spoke to Natalie Hinton, the director of user services at Musselman Library, and she said she made the best decision that she could based on the information that was available, which may beg the question as to why such limited information was available, especially to someone who manages arguably the largest and most populated building on campus at any given time. But digressing from that, Bill Lafferty said that they will be looking into that, and because ultimately, you know, rather than in a power outage turning everyone loose onto the campus when, oh, by the way, none of the streetlights work because the power's out, just when every campus safety notice, including the one sent the week prior, says, you know, don't be out at night, travel in groups, stay away from dark alleys. Well, what do they do when the power goes out? Turn everyone loose in dark alleys at night and potentially not in groups. And oh, by the way, their residence halls are locked because they have card access. So it sounds like they will be looking into all of these procedures. That said, Bill Lafferty said that if they had it to do over again, they'd have done it largely the same way. Jamie, your reaction?
I think that Bill effectively responded to a lot of the concerns that we had. But I do think, you know, and I think it was really important that he acknowledged that there are some issues to look into surrounding why there was a communication breakdown between places like the library and also even dining services. I know that I spoke with some people in the bullet hole who said that they received no communication whatsoever on what was going on and what they should be doing. And they were frustrated about that as well. So I think, you know, looking at more communication and not less, going forward is definitely a laudable goal that Bill has set.
Interestingly, I just want to jump in. There was a trivia event going on in the attic at the time
that kept on going.
They did trivia right on through the power outage.
That's
correct.
I was speaking
to someone who was there helping to keep score, and he said that it was very difficult to keep score in the dark. But, you know, they muscled through. It was, I think, a joint event of college Republicans and college Democrats and maybe the college Independents as well were all involved. And, gee, our politicians or politically minded folks on campus powered through the power outage.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was actually a joint event with those three political groups and the Campus Activities Board and the Attic Advisory Board. It was a great event. But, yeah, it definitely was a little bit dark there for the bulk of the event.
Well,
so,
perhaps the fact that it was host provider helped people to power through a little
yes,
bit.
Yes, and
more.
Luckily the taps work even in a power outage because they're powered by carbon dioxide. So the beer never stopped flowing, because that would be a true campus emergency. If the beer were to stop flowing in the attic, we would have to bring in the National Guard for that, I think.
Yeah, well, glad that wasn't necessary. The other thing I wanted to note was that Bill Lafferty said that during the prior week's incident, when there was allegedly an armed individual who may have been on campus, that and when we called, the dispatcher said to shelter in place, but that was never included in any campus communications. It was never included in any campus communications because that was not actually what decision had been made. There was no decision by DPS to have a shelter in place, that the dispatchers were just making that recommendation to people who called. So Bill said that they would definitely be looking into that as well.
Yeah, it all just circles back to more effective and consistent communication.
And Bill also said that in that incident, they probably would have considered a text message in addition to emails in the future. Interestingly, what's important to note about that is that faculty and staff and administrators only get the text alerts if they opt in.
That's correct.
So when something goes out email only, they all get it. But if something goes out just to the text messages, which is the case after the power goes out on campus, because the campus network, which powers the email server, only works for 45 minutes after a power outage, which seems to me, and Jamie, you're a computer science guy, so I'm intrigued to hear your take on this. But it seems to me that it's a system vulnerability if we can only operate our campus Wi-Fi network, our campus email server, and our college website for 45 minutes after the power goes out. And the power can go out, as we saw, due to a random telephone pole fire.
Yeah, it's something that I think we're going to be looking into in the coming weeks. Definitely, like, a lack of power means that the servers can't run. And, you know, I really wouldn't expect to have full Wi-Fi coverage when the power is out. But the fact that the college website, which is one of the main ways of communicating in the case of an emergency, goes down, you know, only 45 minutes after the power goes out seems a little bit concerning. So that's something that we're going to be looking into. Definitely, I think they should try to push that a little bit longer, because even a mundane outage lasted, you know, 90 minutes.
Well, right. And then once the outage ended, it took the network significantly longer. I think it was another hour almost until it was operational again. It's worth noting that I did ask Jamie Yates that question, the director of media relations and communications, and she said that they do not view that as a system vulnerability. Is it typical, do you think, Jamie, for colleges to host their servers on site, on premises?
It was in the past. I don't know if it still is, but colleges have typically hosted all of their services on site in the past. And I'm not sure that would be interesting. I don't know if other campuses would share that with us because it's proprietary information, but to try to call around and see what sort of, you know, fallback, fail-safe systems other colleges utilize for their websites and for their networks. But yeah, no, that was definitely, I know in the past at least, standard procedure to have your website hosted on a server on site.
And Bill Lafferty mentioned to me, and I don't think I put this in the article, but he mentioned that in the past, there have been conversations about having a joint agreement with another institution in the area or a peer institution of some sort, where they would have backup access to our website and vice versa, and that in the event of a power outage on one campus, the other campus could power the website remotely. And so those conversations will likely be triggered once again. Let's move to our other exciting topic, and that is the fact that in the first little more than 1 month of Senate meetings, the Gettysburg College Student Senate has already allocated, I believe, 31% of their $91,511 operating budget, including more than $12,000 in requests at their most recent meeting that were on the agenda. Jamie, is this spending out of control?
I don't know if it's out of control, but it certainly isn't sustainable. They will run out of money eventually, and they're sure spending it quite quickly.
Yeah, we saw that happen last year. They overspent the new initiatives budget. It's important to note there are two budgets in play here. The new initiatives budget is $91,511 that is appropriated to Senate each year by the college. They also have a rollover account of unspent funds from prior years. And last year, they dipped into that some $23,000. This year, I believe they are looking to avoid dipping into it, but it's unclear how that's going to happen.
Well, then, two things are going to happen if this spending continues. One, we're going to dip into the budget in a big way. Or two, they're just going to stop appropriating money. And clubs in the spring are going to lose out on funds because they're spending all the money in the fall.
I spoke to one student senate officer who told me that they are currently reviewing on the executive board procedures that other institutions use to control spending. Potential ideas include maybe a single night where every budget request for the semester comes and then they whack it up from there. That was one idea that was floated to me by this person. Other thoughts could be, and I think this is in the pipeline potentially, an amendment to the Senate Constitution that, for fundraisers at least, clubs would be required to reimburse Senate after Senate fronts the money for this fundraiser. For example, the Black Student Union was allocated $1,737 at this most recent meeting, and I believe, if I'm recollecting correctly, $400 of that was towards expenses for a fundraiser it held over the weekend. The way it's set up now, they don't have to pay back that $400 to Senate, such that, you know, Senate may as well have just written a $400 check to their cause.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting the way that Senate spends some of its money. A lot of these fundraisers don't end up making enough money to offset all of the expenses.
Which would seem to me to not be so much a fundraiser as a fund loser.
That's correct. But it is, you know, but if you get money from Senate, then that's free money. So that's why the clubs go to Senate to get the money for these fundraisers, because then they can take, even if they don't make enough money to pay back all of the transportation costs, then they still get the, you know, they get to keep any money that comes in because they don't have to pay it back. And I think that the BSU fundraiser was a Chipotle fundraiser, I believe, if I remember correctly. And I know Chipotle doesn't give that much of the profits as part of the fundraiser. I'm not sure how the numbers worked out on that. It'll be interesting to see. But I think it's always something to look at. Another thing is, we spent nearly $4,500 on conference registrations for Model UN.
And that's for 17 students to go to conferences. I want to say it's in somewhere in Europe, I believe.
My question is, why are we paying for certain students with tuition money to go to these conferences, you know, when it's not open to the whole campus community and that money could be spent on, you know, initiatives here on campus? My question is, you know, maybe we need to look at, you know, how we're allocating Senate funds when we're, you know, spending money this quickly and then we're spending it on things like conferences that not everybody can enjoy. That money could be better spent on an event that everyone can go to and benefit from with their tuition money.
I will say that the Model UN event in question is open to anyone who apply. Well, anyone can apply to go, but I believe 17, if I'm recollecting correctly, students are selected to go to this conference. There are two budget requests on the docket for tomorrow's meeting, and interestingly, one of them, by the Disciple Makers Christian Fellowship, they requested $172.99, and the Budget Management Committee recommends no funding for that event, which is not something I have seen in the past. DCF had requested money to host a widow's dinner for, I guess, members of the community, the Gettysburg community. the budget management committee suggested that they reach out to other campus organizations for co-sponsors, and DCF apparently would like the Senate money anyway, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
That's very interesting, because you see there the rationale appears to be that it is not an event for benefiting the student community and the community here on campus. It's for the broader college community, so they don't want to fund it. But then they are funding, and not just Model UN. There's plenty of other conference trips that they fund. And
the pre-veterinary club, I believe, is on the docket for one.
Where students spend... Absolutely. I mean, like, it's insane amounts of money to go to these conferences, and it's one or two people that get to experience it. That's a lot of money per student when it could be better spent elsewhere. Something else that comes to mind is last year there was one student from Smart Women Securities who was sent to the Warren Buffett conference, and it ended up being, I think, either the president or one of the executive board members that went. And it's just interesting, you know, when they say that these are open for anyone to apply, I mean, like, are they really going to choose somebody who's not in their organization to go? I don't know. So I think that that's something that Senate needs to look at and evaluate whether they, you know, if they're going to block a community event like DCS, maybe they need to look at reevaluating whether they spend money on conferences or not.
Yeah. And when you say insane amounts of money, it's not like, we don't want to suggest that these are frivolous amounts of money. I mean, I don't think that they're flying first class to these conferences, but when you look at the, there's a $91,000 budget, there are 2,500 students. When 17 students are allocated $4,000 of the $91,000 budget, almost 5% for less than 1%, and that's assuming that those 17 students don't get any funding from Senate to do anything else the remainder of the year.
Right.
Already, that's quite a proportion, and we're assuming that many students are in more than one club that may petition Senate for funds at some point. So it will be interesting to see how that goes. I know there are other, I know that the College Republicans go to the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, every year.
A whole lot of money was spent on that last year, too. I think the conferences question is one that Senate needs to look at. That's really my opinion, it seems like more and more clubs that in the time that I've been here are jumping on board with the "we want to go to conferences" idea, and conferences are just very, very expensive. I think maybe if Senate doesn't fully fund it, maybe the students should be expected to pick up a larger portion. But anyway, I'm not on Senate, so it's not up to me. But if I were a senator, that would be something I would be looking at.
Yes, and full disclosure, Jamie and I last year did attend a journalism conference, although that was not funded through Senate. The New York Times hosted that event, and it was funded through the provost's office. I just feel like while we're on the conference discussion, it's worth noting that. Let's move on to Open Access Week, which is occurring this week, October the 23rd through the 27th, in Musselman Library, Open Access. And we'll be talking in just a moment with Janelle Wurzberger and Chris Barnes about this issue. But Open Access Week will be, I think the way they're framing it this year is in terms of textbooks. And we, this week in our print edition, published an article written by Gauri Mangala that I would encourage everyone to go read, that profiled Jay Hauser, a student who spent almost $400 for a single course's materials. It was a political philosophy course. We weren't able to talk to the professor of that course. He's no longer at the college. It was a visiting assistant professor at the time. But I think that this is a pervasive issue on campus. I know that I've certainly had courses where materials have cost in excess of $100, $200. I think most students have had that experience. And I think that the Musselman Library is looking to frame these as sort of hidden costs of college. We also spoke with three professors who have pioneered or piloted the use of open educational resources in their own classes, including Darren Glass in the math department, Joseph Brandauer in health sciences, and Ian Clark in the English department. He also is the director of the Hatter Planetarium, but that's just a side note. So it'll be interesting to talk to them. Any thoughts on the textbook crisis, Jamie?
I just know that I spent a lot of money on textbooks. And, you know, I know also another person we didn't speak to, but who has released open educational materials is Chuck Kahn in the computer science department. His materials are actually, I believe, as of last year, they were the most downloaded materials on our Cupola website.
Which is
ever.
Our open access repository.
Right.
Here at Gettysburg.
There are several schools apparently using our his textbooks for circuits and for the MIPS assembly programming language.
And if you have no idea what that means, we're in the same boat.
But anyway, so I did want to mention Chuck Kahn since he is, I believe as of last year, he was still, he had the most downloads in Cupola, so, which is a pretty big achievement. But anyway, we will get to that interview in a couple minutes. But first, I think we have Ben Ponce with our bullet report.
It's been another exciting week in Gettysburg College sports action. This week, the volleyball team lost to Scranton 3-0 on October the 21st. We're going in reverse chronological order because that's the way I picked up my papers. The field hockey team defeated Swarthmore 2-0. The volleyball team lost to Swarthmore 3-2. It's now dropped 5 of its last 6 games. The women's cross-country team finished 2nd of 3rd at the Lebanon Valley Invitational, as did the men's cross-country team on October the 20th. The football team lost 52-0 to Johns Hopkins. That's what you might call a bit of a drubbing. That was yesterday. The women's soccer team lost 2-0 to Swarthmore. That was actually, the football game was on Friday, but that's neither here nor there. The women's soccer team lost 2-0 to Swarthmore. The men's soccer team defeated Swarthmore 3-1. The women's volleyball team picked up their only win of the last 6 games against Messiah on Friday, 3-0. They will look to improve as they got off to a remarkable start and have struggled in recent weeks, but they'll look to get back on track this week. The men's soccer team was defeated by Franklin and Marshall 3-2 on October the 18th. The women's soccer team defeated Susquehanna 2-1. Thus endeth, in a new record time, the Bullet Report.
Ben, it gets faster every time. I don't know how you do it. You're really perfecting your sportscaster voice and cadence. So.
I want to start announcing horse races and coming around the near side and around the outside and, oh my goodness, he won! And it's over in 2 minutes. You got to get a lot of words in those 2 minutes.
I think it's time to change career paths, Ben. I think you're going to need to go
drop
sign
political
up.
Science,
yeah.
Drop public policy, drop my music minor and add we don't have a broadcasting minor.
Yeah.
Or major. Sad.
Sad. Very
All
sad.
All right. Well, we'll be back after this. And we're joined today by Janelle Wurzberger, the Assistant Dean of Scholarly Communications at the Musselman Library, and Chris Barnes, a Scholarly Communications Librarian. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Ben.
Our pleasure.
So we're here today to talk about Open Access Week, which is coming up on October the 23rd through the 27th in the library. And before we get into that, can one of you speak more broadly, what does it mean in the library context for something to be open? You know, we have open access, there are open source software that some people have heard of, perhaps open education resources. Just kind of, what does it mean for something to be open?
That's a great question. Open is a really big umbrella. Open usually means online, free of charge, and free to use however you like, which means you can edit it, revise it, remix it, reuse it. So most people think first, oh, open means free to me, which it does, but it also means the other things.
Mm-hmm. So when we think about open access and open educational resources, what does that mean specifically for libraries and what are we doing here at Gettysburg?
Okay. I think open access is a little bit broader term, so I'll start there. Open access refers to any work. I was about to say publication, but it doesn't have to be formally published. Any work that is online, free to read and free to reuse and edit. So that could mean a published journal article. It could mean a book. It could mean a chapter in a book. It could mean a paper that you wrote for class. It could mean your lab notebook. It could mean a picture of an artwork that you made. It could be anything, as long as it's online, free to access, and free to use.
Mm-hmm.
Open educational resources are a little bit more specific. So those are things that are used in a classroom context. They are open access items, but often people think of open textbooks as the number one kind of open educational resource. But basically anything that you use in the context of a class that's open access is considered an OER. So if you use an open access journal article as an assigned reading in a class, sure, that's an OER. If you use an open data set to do work in your lab, that's an OER. And there are a lot of other examples as well.
Mm-hmm. So I was reading a little bit yesterday about this, and on some online publications were referring to an open access movement. What is the open access movement, and how does our Open Access Week sort of fit into that?
Well, that's another pretty broad topic, but I would say that the open access movement, put simply, is a drive to increase access globally to information that is currently behind paywalls. And as Janelle was saying, it really has a lot of different forms, but here at Gettysburg and at colleges and universities across the country, the institutional repository is the vehicle by which we open access to scholarship from both faculty and students. So when you think open access at Gettysburg, you should really be thinking about the Cupola, our open access institutional repository. And within that are several OERs and many more to come.
Mm-hmm. So the Cupola, as many people may know, is online largely at the college on the library's website at cupola.gettysburg.edu.
Yep.
There we go. And so can you talk a little bit about the history of how the Cupola got started? Was it after a celebration that you were looking to gather that, and that's sort of how it was born?
Yeah, our host has done his homework. Good job, Ben. So we started the Cupola in 2012, and one of the biggest initial impetuses was to collect the outstanding student work that was being presented at our annual Colloquium of Undergraduate Research celebration, which is held every year at the end of the spring semester. And, you know, we had a Mellon grant to get that program started, that undergraduate research program started. And there were all these presentations, and we went, well, what happens to them after the students leave campus for the summer? We should collect them and make them available to other students and, in fact, the whole world. And so that was one of our leading points when we went to the provost's office with a proposal to get started with a repository, but it certainly wasn't the only one. I think that may have been the one that sold it, though. So we indeed, the very first thing that we put in the Cupola was a student work. It was a poster done by Joe Miller. I'm not going to recall his graduation year off the top of my head. It was about a project that he did about the tourism industry in Singapore, and it still gets steady downloads in the Cupola. And I do want to emphasize that even though the Cupola is administered through the library, it is the college's open access institutional repository. It's not the library's repository. It exists, as Chris stated so well earlier, to open access to the scholarship and research that's being done here at Gettysburg College.
So it contains works by students and faculty.
Anyone in the Gettysburg College community. So that includes a lot of other people working in offices around campus as well.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we turn our attention a little bit to textbooks specifically? I know one of the major components coming up of this Open Access Week is the Textbook Broke initiative. And Chris had sent me an email a while back that referred to the textbook crisis. Can you talk a little bit about what the textbook crisis is and, you know, what we're going to be seeing during this Open Access Week in regards to that?
Certainly. So the textbook crisis is a label for the increasingly dire situation on college campuses regarding the increasing price of textbooks. So there have been various studies showing just how crazy the increases for costs for college textbooks have become. They've far exceeded inflation.
Do you want some numbers? I mean, you guys know how expensive your own textbooks are, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the Bureau of Labor Statistics also keeps track of how expensive your textbooks are. And between 2006 and 2016, the cost of textbooks went up 88%. That's even more than the cost of college tuition and fees, which only went up 63%.
Only.
It's also higher than the costs in the healthcare industry and some other things that we think of as exceedingly expensive. So the crisis is that students can't afford the textbooks that their professors assign for their learning. That's the crisis.
And that has a lot of ramifications regarding which classes they choose to take, how well they perform in those classes, and just what majors even they might decide to take based upon textbook prices.
Let's come back to that in a second. What do we think is driving these costs, these increases in costs in textbooks? Is there, you know, research into that that's, you know, available, or?
There's been a lot of research done on the commercial publishing industry and the extent to which they have very, very healthy profit margins. So certainly some of the cost has been coming from the natural evolution, but a lot of it is simply the attempt to make as much money off of the student economy as possible.
And it's these publishing companies that ultimately are reaping the profits, as opposed to, you know, when a faculty member, if a Gettysburg College professor writes a textbook in, I don't know, economics or something, and they write up the textbook and the publisher publishes it, you're saying that the faculty member is not necessarily getting a royalty every time a student buys the book. It's the publishing company that's reaping the majority of those profits.
It depends on the contract. I mean, I think that most authors of books by commercial publishers do get a small royalty, but we're talking small. I've heard some faculty tell me, like, oh, I'm very happy with my royalties. And then I'll push a little bit more and I'll say, well, like, in what's your best year? And they'll say, oh, I got $600 one year. So we're not talking about replacing a salary or anything like that. We're also talking about a very small percentage of faculty authors who make it big. There are some names, you know, you've probably bought books by some of the big authors who do make money, but it's sort of like winning the lottery. Like, you don't write a textbook and sign it over to a commercial publisher because you think you're going to make a heap of cash. You get really lucky if you do, but that's mm-hmm. not how that economy works.
Yeah, and so speaking of sort of the economics of this, I'm not an economics expert, although I do have an econ midterm this afternoon, so we'll get into that. But, you know, it would seem that when faculty are the ones who are assigning students to purchase these textbooks, yet it's students who are purchasing the textbooks, not of their own choosing, it seems there's a bit of a disconnect in how this economy would work, and it seems that publishing companies, you know, sort of can take advantage of that. Is that what you see?
Absolutely.
Am I missing something there?
No, you've hit it right on the head, Ben. It's a curious situation because often the professors who choose and assign the books don't know how much they cost. And the publishers work hard to keep that from them. Publishers are, the way it often works is if you say, you're a professor and you say, I think I might want to switch to this book next year, the publisher will send you a free copy. It's called a review copy so that you can look it over and make a decision. That copy does not have the price printed anywhere on it. Then you say, oh, I like this book, and you send the order over to your bookstore. But you don't know what the bookstore pays for it or what the bookstore is going to charge for it. And those costs have been escalating so much that even if you chose a book for your class the first time you taught it 5 years ago, you may have no idea what the latest edition of it costs, because many publishers, in an effort to reap as high as profits as they can, will release a new edition every year or two. And then when you as a student go try to sell your used copy back to the bookstore or to that little van that parks over on Lincoln Avenue, you get a very, very low price because there's a new edition, and they know that the next round of students buying that book are going to be assigned the new one, not the old one. So one of the questions that we've been asking professors on this campus is, do you know what your books cost your students? Do you know what the price tag is?
And do you get the sense when you ask that question that they do know? Or what's sort of I'm assuming there's a spectrum of some sort there. Where do you see professors on this campus falling into that spectrum?
I see the whole range. Some people really have no idea. Some people have no idea and don't care. But many do care deeply. And I know a number of faculty who have said, oh yeah, I used to use this book. It was the standard in my field. And when it hit this price point, I said, I can't justify it anymore because we only use half the book in my class. And so then they go another way. Maybe they use reserves readings, or maybe they pick a different book, or, you know, there are a lot of different strategies you can use to get away from a single high-priced book. And I see the whole range of things. So part of what we're trying to do is just share the range of those things with faculty, because oftentimes, you know, when you prepare a course, you're doing so with a certain amount of isolation. You know, a lot of different professors teach the same course number on this campus, but rarely do they teach it the same way. So just sharing what other people have done is valuable for everyone.
And that also gets back to the free versus open distinction, because it's great that they're free, but for the faculty member, the fact that they're open means that they can really customize these texts so that they really fit the syllabus and do what they want them to do, as opposed to having to assign a book that only half of the chapters get read. So it's really both the open and the free part that is appealing.
And have you seen the faculty consciousness on this issue change in recent years? Do you think that there's a movement towards using some of these more open or free resources?
I'm going to be optimistic and say that we're at the beginning of a big movement. I have seen some movement, but I think we're approaching a tipping point.
And so you mentioned that there are certain faculty members on this campus who have made that switch. Can you talk about a success story, perhaps?
Sure. One of my favorite stories has to do with an English class, English 111, which is writing about literature. A lot of students take this class. It meets the writing requirement. It's taught by many people, but the person that I've been working with is Professor Ian Clark. And I bumped into him on the sidewalk one day, and he had this gigantic, fat hardcover book hanging up, weighing down his shoulder. And I said, "What's that? It looks expensive." And he said, "Well, this is the new edition of my English anthology, and I'm not happy about it because they just took out a bunch of stuff that I liked, and it's much bigger than it used to be, and it's more expensive." And I said, "Well, have you thought about maybe looking for an open book or pulling together your own list of readings?" And long story short, he did not order that book from the bookstore. And instead, he arranged a series of this class looks at poetry, fiction, and drama. And he found a whole bunch of readings that were in the public domain, and he collected them all in a WordPress site. And his students have no book to buy at the bookstore. So when they go sign up for their class, there's nothing. And they read all of their readings online.
How does the bookstore specifically on the Gettysburg campus play into this? I mean, obviously they're interested in selling books, but are they a potential partner in this?
Yeah, I'm happy to say that they are a potential partner. They are not a Barnes & Noble. They are one of the many independent bookstores across the country. And when I approached them, they told me about efforts they had already been making. As you're well aware, you know, when you go to the bookstore, you can rent, you can get used copies. Those are all available to you. And so they're well aware of the textbook crisis and are working with us to raise awareness and potentially make some interventions in the way in which faculty purchase and order textbooks.
We'll have a couple of books on display during Open Access Week that are open access textbooks that were purchased at the Gettysburg College Bookstore. There's a big open textbook publisher called OpenStax, and we'll have a physics book and a biology book on display that are being used in classes right now. They are open textbooks. You can read them for free online. But if you prefer a hard copy, as many students do, they're easier to mark up, flip back and forth. Some people just prefer print. They have low-cost print copies available. It depends on how many pages there are. So the physics book, for example, is a lot thicker than the biology one, and it runs $48. It's a hardcover book, plenty of color printing in it. It's a really nice quality book, and it will have it on display so people who are not in that class can have a look at it. The biology book was running more like $30. Mm-hmm. So when you compare that to some others that are for sale in the bookstore, it looks like a real bargain.
Yeah. It seems like largely this textbook issue is, I don't want to make this sound like it's an accusatory statement, but it's a scholar or faculty created phenomenon in that, you know, it's faculty who are doing the writing of these books, the publishing companies who are, you know, publishing them and charging for them, and then the faculty who are assigning them. So it seems that if, you know, you can build momentum at the faculty level towards this open access initiative, that could be where the paradigm starts to shift. Do you get that sense? Or, you know, how do you go about building momentum at the faculty level on this issue?
Well, first I want to say that the situation you describe is true of scholarly journals and scholarly monographs, but not necessarily for textbooks. So some textbooks are written by professors and some are not. Those commercial publishers have huge offices full of writers that collect information from here and there. So it's not always the case that faculty are writing those books. However, they are assigning them. And this is one, you know, sometimes faculty grumble about the price of tuition as it keeps going up or whatever. But the cost of the materials for their courses is something that's completely within their control. And so I really encourage faculty to engage with that and to think, you know, this is a place where I can decide what's right for my class and what the right price point is. You were going to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to point out how faculty, once they are made more aware about the movement, the OA movement, and especially the OER component of that, are relatively new. And faculty have been stuck in a sort of broken system in many ways. And so we want to be careful about you know, assigning any sort of blame in this regard. We're still at a time where we're raising consciousness and, you know, allowing faculty to see the full range of options out there. But it is a key time. It is a time when these questions need to be asked, and the situation is just growing worse by the semester.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons that our scholarly communications program at Musselman Library offers support to faculty who are looking to adopt or adapt or create open educational resources. We think that's an important service right now in 2017, and it's one that we're prepared to offer.
And so the cupola, as you mentioned, is sort of the institutional repository for faculty to publish in open access journals. I wanted to ask, I know that Harvard has a policy that in 2008, Harvard's Faculty of Arts and Sciences unanimously voted to give the university a non-exclusive, irrevocable right to distribute their scholarly articles for any non-commercial purpose. And in the years since, remaining Harvard schools voted similar open access policies. So, you know, at Harvard, which is arguably one of the premier, not arguably, is probably unanimously considered one of the premier educational institutions in the country, there's, you know, a mandatory, for lack of a better term, rule that faculty research gets published in an open way. Would you support something like that happening at Gettysburg? And would you ever see something like that happening at Gettysburg through the cupola or through another medium?
Mm-hmm. I would support that happening at Gettysburg, but that's in librarianship, we refer to that kind of statement as a faculty mandate. And if we were to publish such a thing, it would need to come from the faculty, not from the library. It would come before the full faculty meeting. There would be discussion, there would be voting, et cetera. Now, the way that policy works is that the faculty authors of Harvard give to Harvard a non-exclusive license, which means, do we want to go into the legal part?
I think we should.
Okay. So first, the difference between a license and a copyright. Copyright is more like owning a house, and a license is more like renting a house. So if you give someone a license, you still own your copyright. You still control the work, but you're saying, I'll let you do this thing that I tell you you can do with it. And non-exclusive is not exclusive. You only have one exclusive license that you can give, but you can give many people a non-exclusive license. So in terms of the legal language, a non-exclusive license makes me smile. Whenever I see that phrase, I think, yes, that's the way I want it to be. And in fact, when students give us permission to put their work in the cupola here at Gettysburg, they give us a non-exclusive license. So I want everybody to hear non-exclusive license and think, yay, that's good. I want a non-exclusive license. So at Harvard, what the faculty do, they voted that they would give Harvard a non-exclusive license to publish their work before it even went to a journal or a book publisher for consideration. So the idea is that the faculty there self-deposit their work in the Harvard repository at the same time that they submit it to a journal. So the version that they submit to the repository is sometimes called a preprint. It's like the original manuscript. Now that so they submit it to the repository, they send it off to a journal to be considered, to go through the peer review process. The article that pops out the other end of that pipeline is probably different than the one that went into their repository, because it went through a revision process and peer review. It was copy edited and so forth. And so it's not really the same work anymore. The author usually gives the journal publisher copyright over that final article, but the author, the faculty author, owns copyright over the original manuscript at the point that they make it, and so they can deposit it. At Harvard, they rely on the faculty to self-deposit into the repository. That is not how we're getting stuff into the cupola here at Gettysburg. I think that we would not have nearly as successful a repository if we told faculty, you have to create an account and upload your work and type in the title and put in the metadata. Like, they wouldn't do it. That it's just not a priority in their day-to-day work. So the library has taken on that kind of work. So we don't see it early in the process when they submit it to a publisher. We see it after it pops out the other end. So what we do at Gettysburg is we check the copyright permissions that the faculty gave to those publishers. And if the copyright holder, which is usually not the author anymore, if the copyright holder permits us to put the full work in the cupola, we do so.
Mm-hmm. And what do you have a percentage of faculty work that is in the cupola?
Yeah, I do. That's something that I track pretty carefully every year. It's running around 50%. So I think I have a pretty good handle on all the work that the faculty here publish, because we have a longstanding tradition, about 20 years now, of having a college author reception every year in the spring. It's co-sponsored by the provost office and the library. And faculty have gotten into the habit of self-reporting their publications because they want them to be honored at this fancy schmancy reception, right? So I get the information that they submit on that form, and then I go track down, or someone on my team tracks down the copyright permissions for those. And when it's legal for us to put it in the cupola, we do so. When it's not legal, we ask permission anyway, because the worst they can say is no. And sometimes we get some more yeses that way. So we get about half. For calendar year 2016, it was 47%. It moves around from year to year. So that's, we don't have a mandate like Harvard does, but we still have about half of our faculty's officially published scholarship open access in the cupola.
I guess the two other questions, and then we'll wrap this up. I think a lot of students, when they're conducting research, get hung up on, you know, I need peer-reviewed articles. Are articles that, can an open access article be peer-reviewed? Are there
Absolutely.
Peer-reviewed open access journals?
Yes. There are also regular journals that are not peer-reviewed, you know.
Yeah, it's a really important among the open access community that we maintain the same standards for the paywalled content, and that moving forward, there's no lessening in quality among OA resources.
Mm-hmm. And okay, I lied. There are still two more questions I have. One thing that I thought was a little interesting that you just said jogged my memory is that you had mentioned that the OA movement is sort of intertwined with social justice related issues. And can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So if you imagine a researcher in Africa working as part of a team on a research project, and that team is based not just in Africa, but in Europe and North America, there's a good chance that when that publication eventually comes out, if it's in one of the top tier journals, that the researcher at the African University is not going to have access to that very journal article that they co-authored, simply because their university can't afford the very high subscription rate that journal demands. And so this is a problem throughout the world, but especially in the global south. And if you think about the ramifications of science and learning and knowledge being kept behind paywalls, you can see how there's a very easy social justice component to this.
There have been some pieces written about how, like, the Ebola scare from a few years ago could have been prevented if public health workers had access to paywall journal content that had been out there for a decade prior to that. If they could have gotten that, they could have addressed it in a different way than they were able to. The other thing we need to think about in terms of global north, global south, is that open access journal publishing is the standard in part of the global south. In particular, in Latin America, they have a fantastic repository called Cielo. I've heard it pronounced both ways. And their governments have taken on responsibility for funding this organized set of peer-reviewed journals. And so authors in those countries publish in those journals rather than trying to get them into the expensive journals in other parts of the world. But are researchers in North America and Europe reading that content, even though it is open access? I mean, open access is good, but we don't want to use it in a colonial kind of way. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we'll let you read our stuff because we're so awesome. Like, we want to be careful to avoid those tropes.
And Gettysburg College students, while they're here, exist in this wonderful bubble of sorts, because they have access to all of these resources because their tuition dollars go towards funding that, right? But once they graduate, it is a major downer to realize that all of a sudden you don't have access to all of these resources that you say might want to look at for preparing for graduate school or your new career. And so it's not just about, you know, Global South and North. It's about just access for everyone when they need it.
Mm-hmm. And so bringing it back to Open Access Week, what sorts of things are students going to see? How should they be getting involved? And what's the overarching goal from the SCALCOM department to, for this week?
We have so many goals, but we'll focus on our outreach to students because you're a student, and I think this podcast is mostly about students. So we would like to crowdsource some data for the we're taking the textbook broke challenge. So I'm using my hands, which I realize you can't see on the radio.
She's doing air
hashtag
quotes.
That's right. There's a hashtag textbook broke out there. And if you look it up on Twitter or other places, you'll see tons of stuff about it. So we're going to have a giant interactive graph set up on the main floor of Musselman Library. And we would like students to tell us what's the most you've ever spent on textbooks in a single semester. You're going to put your number on a post-it and you're going to post it on the graph. So the numbers are going to go from $0 to $1,000 for a semester. And then we'll have columns for what's your major, arts and humanities, social sciences, or sciences. And we're going to collect this information as well as some free responses about strategies that students use to successfully access their textbooks, whether you buy them at the bookstore or use any of a number of other methods to get the stuff you need. And we're going to use that to share it back with the faculty in our outreach as the year continues. There is an Open Education Week in the spring, and so we'll probably see those numbers come back then. We'll have a book display that goes with that graph that features some of the textbooks that we've been describing that are being used in some classes right now. And we'll be over in the Cub at a Cub table Monday through Thursday of Open Access Week with some of those materials as well to try to catch people.
In terms of overarching goals, as I'm sure you have taken away from this conversation, raising awareness both among faculty and students is really our major goal.
Mm-hmm. Chris Barnes and Janelle Wurzberger, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Ben.
That's On Target for this week. We'd like to thank Janelle Wurzberger and Chris Barnes for being our featured guests today.
We'd also like to thank the staff of the Gettysburgian and the executive board of WZBT for their support of this project. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever else you get your podcasts, as long as it's somewhere that we publish.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysburgian and WZBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha of the Class of 2019, who is a music major focusing on composition from the Sunderman Conservatory of Music.